Gracias por descargar este podcast de Hey Festival. Para más información sobre nuestros festivales internacionales y sobre cómo acceder a nuestro archivo, por favor visite heyfestival.org. Gracias.
It is a tremendous privilege for all of us to have the opportunity to spend this afternoon here in Cartagena in the company of one of the leading intellectuals in the world, Professor Steven Pinker. Professor Pinker, thank you very much for accepting our invitation to the High Festival.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Okay, I also would like to thank the organizers for giving me this magnificent opportunity to be here with one of my intellectual heroes. And I also want to thank you for joining us this evening. So I know Professor Pinker needs no introduction, but I'm going to read just a couple of paragraphs. Professor Pinker is a Jonestown Family Professor in the Department of Psychology at Harvard University. He conducts research on language and cognition, and he is frequently invited to write for publications such as the New York Times, Time, and the New Republic. He's the author of 10 books, including The Language Instinct, How the Mind Works, The Blank Slate, The Stuff of Thought, The Better Angels of Our Nature, and most recently, The Sense of Style. So, Professor Pinker has been named one of the world's most influential intellectuals. He has won awards from the American Psychological Association, the National Academy of Sciences in the United States, of course, the Royal Institution, the Cognitive Neuroscience Society, and the American Humanist Association. He has also served on the editorial boards of a variety of journals, and he has frequently participated in public debates concerning scientific and social issues. So I intend this afternoon to have a conversation mostly about academic topics, but I'm sure many of us would like to know a little bit about Steve, the person behind the books and the wonderful ideas. So I will take the liberty to ask you about some other issues of a more personal character, if that's okay with you.
Okay. It's okay.
Okay, so on the other hand, I have to apologize to the audience because I will avoid subjects related to politics. I will skip all sorts of questions concerning the ongoing negotiations with Las FARC, for example. Well, we are going to talk for 45 minutes, so you will have, at the end of our talk, 15 minutes left for questions and comments. So if you want to do that, also I understand that you tend not to like those questions about politics very much, so I don't know. Well, it depends, that's of course. Well, and finally, since English is not my native language, and since any language that is acquired after adolescence is spoken with great difficulty, as Professor Pinker explains in one of his books, I apologize for all the inconveniences this may cause. Okay, so let me start this conversation, Steve, with a subject that is recurrent in most of your books and talks and could be framed within, I would call, the nature-nurture debate. This is about human nature. So in one of your books, for example, The Blank Slate, this, I understand that The Blank Slate is a book in which, it, to me, is a refutal of this hypothesis, the very implausible hypothesis, that we are born as empty receptacles or blank slates. And however, and this is adopted by most social scientists. So I would like to ask you, how would you explain the persistence in the academic world of a model for which, in my opinion, there is very little, if any, empirical evidence to support it?
Yes, the book, The Blank Slate, which I think was translated into Spanish as La Tabula Rasa, the scraped tablet from Aristotle and then John Locke, refers to the idea that there is no such thing as human nature, that we are born blank slates, which are then written on by our parents and our culture. And I think quite apart from the whatever empirical merits it may or may not have, it has acquired a kind of moral valuation that people, many people believe it's the morally correct position. For, I think, four reasons that I try to differentiate in the blank slate. The first is a fear of inequality, that if you're committed to inequality, the idea that people are born with anything implies that some people might have more of it than others, whereas if people are blank slates, then, well, zero equals zero equals zero, we have to be identical. Now, if you believe in human nature, it doesn't necessarily mean that you believe that differences between people are innate. You could believe in a universal human nature. But either way, I don't think that it has the moral and political implications that people fear in the first place. I think this is a bad fear, because the desire for political equality is not the same as the desire that, it should not be the same as the desire that people are clones, that we're just indistinguishable from one another. It's an equality of rights, of opportunity.
Right.
And it's perfectly compatible with the idea that some people might be a little bit smarter or more anxious or more generous or more stingy or more neurotic than others, which I think is what the data suggest. The second fear is the fear that you can't perfect humankind. That if we're blank slates, then if you just write the right stuff on the blank slate, then people will be cooperative and harmonious and generous. And whereas if we're born with traits, maybe they're nasty, ugly traits like selfishness or dominance or revenge. Mm-hmm. Now I happen and the sorry, just to complete the fear of that we're not blank slates. The fear is that if people are just born bad, then there's no point in trying to improve society. People are just rotten. They'll just screw it up no matter what you do. So why bother trying to make the world a better place? I think that's right. A mistake also, because even if you believe that people do have some traits that lead to violence, as I believe we have, such as the desire for revenge, that's not the only thing we have. Human nature is complex. I think there are many different circuits in the brain. And though we do have circuits for rage and dominance and revenge and sadism, we also have circuits for self-control, for empathy, for moral norms, for cognitive processes that allow us to pursue rational solutions to problems. And I, of all people, have argued that over the course of history, human behavior can change, has changed, and has changed for the better. Even if human nature has been the same, are the rate at which we actually commit acts of violence has gone down, and we'll come back to that.
Right. And at the same time, I think there is a misunderstanding when people think that something is something that you inherited. Somehow they believe that this is a fixed trait somehow. But the mechanism how culture interacts with genes is something that is still a little bit mysterious, isn't it? I mean,
yes, very much so. Whatever we inherited is certainly not we're not robots, and it's not as if our genes make us kill, make us hate, make us do anything directly. It's the genes help to shape the brain. The brain takes in information from the environment, including the cultural environment. And what we actually do depends on our interpretation of our world, which very much can change as the world changes.
Well, but at the same time, I understand that there may be political reasons for not liking the theory, but for cultural anthropologists, for example, for anyone for that matter, I think one doesn't have to be an expert to notice certain human universals, for example, the ubiquitous presence of language, morals, humor, we all speak, laugh, cry, and as people as Donald Brown, I understand they have documented hundreds, literally hundreds of human universals. So this is an empirical body of knowledge that should be taken into account, in my opinion, but is completely ignored.
Yes, it's odd that our common humanity became, at some point in the 1960s and 1970s, politically incorrect. It's considered a dangerous reactionary doctrine. I personally think, if anything, it is an encouraging, uplifting doctrine, because it means that we have common ground. And in fact, the people that I've spoken to who try to negotiate at the end of conflict say that they often appeal to a universal human nature to transcend some of these differences. They say, for example, in the Middle East, well, yes, I know you guys are Muslims and you guys are Jews, but we all care about our children. That's a human universal,
and that's
the kind of thing that you build on often in peacemaking efforts.
Yes. There are many respected thinkers, people like, for example, Richard Lewontin, which is a professor at Harvard, I understand, a biologist, and intellectuals such as Leon Cass and the Argentinian philosopher, for example, Mario Bunge, and they regard sociobiology, which is, I think, the original name, right, for the evolutionary psychology, as a classical example of bad science or bogus science. How would you respond to those criticisms?
Well, they have different motives. For Leon Cass, who is was the chair of the bioethics panel convened by President George W. Bush, his concern was not with evolutionary psychology, but with any scientific analysis of human emotion and value, including neuroscience, including just ordinary experimental psychology. He thought that the scientific approach to humanity threatened our humanity, it tended to rob our dignity and reduce love to hormones or caring for your children to genetic self-interest. And he is very much on the political right, as you could guess by the fact that George W. Bush picked him as his bioethics guru. Lewontin comes from the complete opposite end of the spectrum. He's a Marxist on the political left, and the idea of human nature has always been anathema to Marxism. Marxists adamantly deny that it makes sense even to raise the question of human nature. And it also means that you can't simply reform society according to a blueprint and hope that people will behave according to that blueprint. In terms of applying evolution to understanding human emotion and cognition, my answer is, first of all, how can you not? The famous biologist, in fact, as Lewontin's own advisor, Theodosius Dobzhansky, has famously said, nothing in biology makes sense except in the context of evolution. It asks the question why the brain works the way it does, rather than just saying, here's the way the brain works, don't ask me why, it just does. Because I said so, you have to take the next step and say, what is vision for? What is fear for? Why do we get jealous? And ultimately, that answer is going to have to pertain to evolution. Now, of course, coming up with a hypothesis is only the beginning of scientific investigation. Then you have to spell out the empirical predictions of a hypothesis and test them. And that's just ordinary psychology.
And there have been tremendous advances in the cognitive sciences and psychology and everything, and this body of knowledge is having a tremendous impact on the humanities, in my opinion. Do you think that probably we are at the brink of a revolution similar to the scientific revolution at the time of Copernicus and Galileo? Do you think that in, let's say, 10, 20 years, we might see a big change in the way the humanities are presented and the way anthropology is studied, or what do you think?
Yes. No, I do think that there are tremendously exciting possibilities for integrating knowledge, for building bridges between the two silos of the sciences on the one hand and the humanities on the other. Simply because what are the humanities? What is painting? What is literature? What is music? What is poetry? What is history? These are all products of human brains.
Right.
Why do we enjoy music? Well, there's something about the way brain circuitry works, some combination of the auditory system and the language system and the emotional system that come together in a certain way that makes music possible. Poetry uses the resources of language, of meter and rhyme and alliteration and the structure of words, the structure of phrases. Fiction is about also uses language, of course, but it is about the great themes of human conflict, parent against child, man and woman, friend and friend, enemy and enemy. And I think we have every reason to expect that our best scientific understanding of how humans behave and how the mind works would have insight to offer the understanding of the products of the brain, namely the subject matter of the humanities, and of course, vice versa. The scientific study of the mind and the brain has very much to learn from historians and archaeologists and literary critics and music theorists and so on. I've made enormous use of the work of humanities scholars in my attempt to understand language and violence and music and so on. Now, it's odd that this should even be controversial, because it would seem to be obvious, and for until the 20th century, all of the great Enlightenment thinkers were scientists as much as they were humanities scholars. They were avid consumers of the science of their day. They proposed psychology hypotheses, evolutionary hypotheses, and it was only as academia started to break into different camps that the idea that they should be completely separate arose. There are humanities scholars who are terrified that this will mean a hostile takeover of the humanities, and you know, they'll be out of a job. It'll just be nothing but yes. People with brain scanners will put the literary critics out of business, and that is not going to happen. Yeah. I think all disciplines have something to learn from other disciplines studying the same thing in the world, and the thing in the world we're understanding is human nature.
There are some other aspects of human nature that I would like to talk about. For example, morality is something that is very interesting. In The Better Angel, so far, nature, you have argued very persuasively with excellent arguments about something that is very counterintuitive, which is the decline of violence throughout history. So I think that the whole argument presupposes that it is possible to speak of moral progress. Do you think it is possible to speak that makes sense, to speak of moral progress, that somehow we human beings, are more mature in a way, if I may use the word, than, let's say, in the Middle Ages?
Yeah. I do think it makes sense to talk about moral progress, even though I realize that this sounds kind of antique and old-fashioned, Whiggish, as they say, Whig history.
Right.
But if it's more moral not to kill people than to kill people, if it's less moral to enslave people than letting people be free, if it's immoral to sacrifice an innocent person to please angry gods, and so we no longer throw virgins into volcanoes and right. cut up people open to take their hearts out to satisfy the great gods, if that's not moral progress, then what does progress mean? What does morality mean?
Well, there are people, I suppose, that question the whole idea. The idea of progress in any, even in biology, has been put into, you know, questioned by many people. So I suppose that many people would think that speaking of moral progress is something, you know, that made sense. People thought that this was something that you could talk about in a sensible way, but not anymore.
Yeah, so I treat it as an empirical issue. Namely, that is, I think the reason that that many intellectuals began to sneer at the idea is that it came out of Victorian thinking, and it was seen to be some mystical law of nature, that in evolution, organisms progress, and then the culmination of biological evolution was man, and then man carries this process onward with the advance of civilization, and often this was used as a way of for Western and European societies to claim that they were morally superior to those in the Americas and Africa and Asia. So it got a kind of colonialist, racist taint. So there are versions of the notion of progress that are disreputable, but I think that there is a different notion of progress that is not just respectable, but I think indispensable. Namely, you try to come to an agreement on what is good. Namely, and I think it's not that hard to come to a worldwide agreement. It's better for people to live than to die. It's better for people to be healthy than sick. It's better for people to have knowledge than to be ignorant. Better for people, for children to go to school and know how to read and write than to be illiterate. Many of these statements were ratified in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, so it's not that hard to come up with an agreement about what's right or what's wrong. The whole world has come to an agreement. Well, then you try to measure it, and that's what social scientists and economists have increasingly tried to do. What percentage of the world's population is literate? How long, on average, do people live? How many people every year are killed in wars? How many people every year are killed in homicides? Once you have those data for different periods in history, you can plot them on a graph, and then it becomes an empirical question. Has there been progress or not? And my argument is, when you define progress that way, there absolutely has been progress, enormous progress. My book was about violence, and I plotted many graphs that showed rates of violence coming down over the course of history. But if you look at other measures of human well-being, like longevity, like literacy, like infant mortality, like maternal mortality, women dying in childbirth, almost anything you want to measure, the world has gotten better, on average. Not everywhere. There's still discrepancies. There's still violence. There's still hunger. There's still disease. But taking the world as a whole, there has absolutely been advancement.
Okay, but some people might say, for example, that there are enormous differences in the perception of what has been considered right and wrong among different societies throughout history. So if we can speak of moral progress, and if we could speak of a universal core of moral principles or a moral instinct, as people like Harris, they speak about that, those things, but and then how can you explain that, you know, slavery was something that was considered right, not wrong? I mean, it's not that they were wicked and then, you know, that they knew that they were doing something that was not right. They thought, I think, that they were doing something that was, you know, permitted and was good.
I mean,
good for their society. So it's a totally different perception of what we consider now moral than what it was a century ago, let's say.
Yes. No, that, I think you raise an excellent point. And in fact, in my book, The Better Angels of Our Nature, I have a statement that the world has far too much morality. That if you were to add up all of the people who've been killed for moral reasons, then it would vastly outnumber the number of people who are killed for selfish reasons. So if you look at ideological genocides like Mao and Hitler. If you look at religious wars and persecutions where people are killed because they have the wrong theory of who is the correct heir of Muhammad or what is the correct interpretation of Christianity. If you look even at the level of one-on-one killings, a surprising number are done for moral reasons. It's not as if someone's wearing a gold chain and a murderer comes up and kills them so they can have the gold chain. I mean, that happens.
Right.
But probably the largest category of murders are for forms of justice. The murderer feels that he has been unfairly insulted or wronged, and he is acting as judge, jury, and executioner. So by his own standards, he would say that what he's doing is moral. The question is, how does that change over time? And I think it does change over time. I think that itself may be one of the most important drivers of moral progress, is changing what you count as moral.
Right.
If morality is obeying commandments in scripture, or accepting this Messiah but not accepting that Messiah, or promoting national glory and honor, then you're right. Actually, morality will lead to terribly morality in the sense of the moral sense, moral intuitions, lead to immoral outcomes. But what I think happens is that as people are forced to defend their version of morality to someone else, as you start to include greater and greater parts of the world in your discussion of morality, and if you get to have free speech, you're not allowed to kill someone you disagree with. That's the first rule.
Right.
Well, the conversation is going to go in a certain direction. And you can see this historically. So let's take the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which was signed in 1948, and largely is on the effort of Eleanor Roosevelt. So let's say you were writing a Universal Declaration of Human Rights and you wanted every country in the world to agree to it. say, number one, we must accept Jesus Christ as our Savior. Well, then you write off India and you write off Japan, and it's just a non-starter. So scratch that. So, you know, anything about Mohammed, scratch that. What can you put in there that everyone will agree with? Well, people tend to agree on things like, you know, health is better than sickness, and literacy is better than illiteracy, and living is better than dying. And what you end up with when you try to universalize the debate on morality, I think, is a remaining core of morality that can be better defended, that's not parochial or provincial. Right. And because of the globalization of ideas, I think that's a force that pushes the world toward greater, what you might call even objective morality.
Right, suppose things like suffering, disease.
Suffering, disease,
hunger. Things that
hunger.
Nobody wants that for a child, for example, for your own child. So if you inflict pain on someone, then that's something that is going to, that is something that is going to be considered something wicked everywhere in the world. I mean, you know, it's something that is not. But now it occurs to me, what about, for example, there are people like Sabater, you know, the philosopher. He thinks that this moral sense or this moral thing does not extend to animals. So he wants to, for example, defend his idea that bullfighting is okay, it's fine. But since we are just by continuity animals, we are animals too. I mean, we are not angels. So this moral things should extend to animals as well. What do you think?
Yes, I think that's a profound issue. And of course, the other way in which that logic is taken is by philosophers like Peter Singer, who say that since the basis for these universal values, like life is better than death and suffering is, being free of pain is better than suffering, then they really don't pertain to Homo sapiens. They pertain to sentience, to consciousness. And so any other creature that has the capacity to suffer should also be factored into morality. And I think it's very hard to argue against Singer. But just as Singer takes his theory of animal rights and he embeds it in a more ambitious theory of moral progress. In fact, many of my ideas were influenced by Singer, which he calls the expanding circle.
Sure.
And that by the same logic that says, I can't privilege me over you, or my ethnic group over your ethnic group, or my race over your race, just because I'm me and you're not. Well, you're going to say, why should I accept that? I mean, what's so special about you? It's like saying, well, this is a unique, special spot on Earth because I happen to be sitting in it. It's just the logic won't work. Well, that follows with animals to the extent that they can suffer the way that we do. Now, where you draw the line, should we protect the rights of oysters or cockroaches?
Right.
I think at some point our ethical intuitions start to break down when we don't really know what kind of consciousness they have.
Well, and intuitively, nobody has any problem, for example, killing bacteria, I think.
Exactly, okay. Yes.
Right. Yes.
So where do you draw the line between bacteria and chimpanzees?
And chimpanzees, right.
Yeah.
It is very hard. So now we started talking about, you said that one of the reasons for the adopting the standard social model, as it is called, is that people feel comfortable, that people are afraid of, you know, that there might be differences. So I would like to ask you about this topic of gender differences. It is taboo, you know, even to mention the possibility that there may be significant differences in the cognitive abilities of men and women. And for example, the disparity in gender between the number of faculty members that are mathematicians or physicists in practically all universities all over the world. This is a fact. I mean, nobody can deny this. But people tend to explain these differences as differences in opportunities and by some other cultural factors. So how would you respond to those people? Do you think that these differences truly exist? I mean, beyond the trivial ones.
Yeah. I think there are two issues here that are often confused. One of them is, does sex discrimination exist, and should we make efforts to eliminate it? And there, I think the answer is obviously it does exist, and yes, we obviously should make efforts to eliminate it, because it runs against the value of fairness.
But I'm thinking more about the position of the radical feminists, for example, which is not only that is not only the fight for women rights, but it's just that the whole idea that there might be differences is something that they do not accept. Curiously, some of the best researchers in this area and these areas are women, like Diane Halpern, for example.
Yes, I think there's. I think these issues very much have to be distinguished. That there's even within feminism, there are very different schools of feminism, and in particular, there's Christina Hoff Sommers distinguishes between equity feminism, the right. idea that discrimination against women is wrong and ought to be eliminated, and what she calls gender feminism, which, among other things, believes in a very strong version of the blank slate, namely men and women are biologically indistinguishable, at least their brains are, and that all differences between men and women are the result of socialization and discrimination. And I think you don't have to believe that in order to be a feminist, you don't have to believe that men and women are identical. And in fact, I think that's very harmful to feminism, at least in the equity feminism version, because it means that if the scientific data show that men and women aren't identical, well, you're supposed to say, oh, well, I guess we'll have to give up feminism. It was a mistake, and go back to the days when women were in the right. kitchen. It's a terrible idea. The value of feminism is as a political and ethical ideal, the ideal of fairness and non-discrimination, and it shouldn't be confused with the question of are men and women biologically identical. And I find in my experience, by the way, that even many people who argue academically that men and women are identical, they don't live their lives that way. I mean, they couldn't.
Right.
They couldn't tell their teenage daughters, oh, by the way, just remember the boys and the girls, they're exactly the same. Or their own lives, when they gossip about, you know, people that they date or friends that are in bad relationships, no one has that conversation without a primary assumption that men and women have some different traits. And it's often, for that matter, feminists who say, often correctly, in a meeting in which there's a lot of male posturing that's a kind of a waste of time, oh, you know, typical alpha male behavior, too much testosterone. And of course, I think they're right. And it can be a very powerful weapon to realize that that there are quirks of both sexes that sometimes get in the way of the best way to run our lives.
Yes, okay. Well, I would like to ask you about some other topics since we have about 10 minutes left. So I would like to switch to language, which is one of your, let's see what happens here. So in one of your, in your most recent book, The Sense of Style, you are very critical of this disastrous habit in many academic circles of using pedantic and obscure language. So I take this opportunity to ask you about what you think about postmodern writers. And I'm not going to name specific names,
you know who you are.
But in general, what you think about the whole movement is, you know, in. Yeah.
Well, so in my most recent book, which has not been translated into Spanish yet, in English it's called The Sense of Style, The Thinking Person's Guide to Writing in the 21st Century. So that's my first attempt at applying the science of language to a practical and, in this case, clear writing. And academics are infamous for writing badly, and postmodernists are infamous for being bad, even by the standards of academics. probably the worst of the worst. So ironically, it's the English departments, I think, that produce some of the most hilariously bad writing. I think it's not a coincidence, because one of the analyses that I make in the book is that to be a good writer, you have to adopt a kind of mental model as to what you're trying to accomplish when you write. Good writing is not a question of looking at a bunch of rules and saying, well, I should not split an infinitive, and this is where the semicolon goes. It's really a question of starting out with the right attitude. And the attitude that leads to, I think, the best nonfiction writing has been called classic style. And it's one in which the model is of seeing an objectively existing world. So here's the model. I, the writer, have seen something in the world. The reader has not yet noticed it. I position the reader so that she can see it for herself, using conversation. But the goal is to get the reader to see something in the world that I have seen that they have not yet noticed. And there is an equality between the writer and the reader. In good writing, the writer assumes that the reader is as competent, as smart as the writer, but just has not yet noticed something that the writer has noticed. Now, that is a kind of naive realism. It's not that far from the point of view of scientists, namely there's an objective reality and we're trying to all see the same reality, but it is as far as you can imagine from the worldview of postmodernism, where objectivity is a myth, there is nothing but the text. Oh, another feature of classic style is the idea that the words and the thoughts are different. Words are ways of conveying thoughts, right. But the point is not just to go blah, 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 blah. The point is to use words as a window or as a medium. And again, that is completely opposite to the doctrine of postmodernism. And that's why I think it's not a coincidence that postmodernists are bad writers. Their own theory of the world prevents them from using the right model to write.
Right. This idea of identifying words with thought itself, this is something a little bit strange, for example, for a mathematician, it's pretty obvious that many times, most of the time, you understand something, and much later, you can explain that in words. I mean, even though you understand it, this is something, not even for mathematicians, in many occasions in life, you know that you already you understood something, but it's just much later that you can translate it somehow into words, as if it were like a process of printing something that was already in the computer. You have spoken about this notion of mentales or mentalis, this language that we have, let's say this machine language that we have. Can you elaborate a little bit about
that? Yeah, so that's right. So this relates to a popular, but I think incorrect theory of how the mind works, which is that we think in the sentences of our native language, that if you speak Spanish, you think in Spanish, and if you speak English, you think in English. Right. And the word mentalis, which I took from Jerry Fodor, captures the idea that there is something in thought that is much more abstract than language, that we try to put communicate our thoughts using language, but our goal is to get someone to have the same sentence or representation in mentalese that we have. And that they relate indirectly, that for every, when a word has multiple meanings, as most words do, that's a kind of immediate demonstration that words and thoughts can't be the same thing, because one word can refer to many thoughts.
Right.
You can have paraphrases where it's the same thought but different wording. You can have translation. Translation would not even be a coherent concept if there weren't such a thing as meaning that would sit in between the sentences of English, the sentences of Spanish. So as you're all hearing me over these earpieces, you better hope that language and thought are not the same thing. Otherwise, it wouldn't matter what the translator said. He could say anything in Spanish, and it would be fine.
So let me ask you a final question about language. It's more of a curiosity that I have, is that Wittgenstein is a figure that is revered by many for his contributions to the understanding of thought and language. In his masterpiece, Philosophical Investigations, that piece of work is considered as being one of the most significant works in philosophy. However, I have the impression that you mention him very little in your books, or you hardly mention him. So what is your opinion on the transcendence of Wittgenstein's contribution to our current understanding of mind and language?
Well, there's one area in which Wittgenstein has had an enormous influence in psychology, and I put up a picture of Wittgenstein on the screen when I lecture to my undergraduates, and that is in our understanding of concepts. What is a concept? So what does the word dog mean, or game, or man, or bachelor, or woman, or vegetable? Classic understanding of concepts was that they are definitions, that a bachelor is an adult human male who has never been married. And Wittgenstein challenged the idea that any concepts underlying words have exact definitions. He used the example of game. Like, how could you come up with any definition of game that would include chess and football and a child throwing a ball against the wall and solitaire and cards? That instead, the different examples of a concept are related like the members of a family. Family members don't have one trait that goes that is possessed by every member of the family, but this brother might resemble that sister, who might resemble the father, who might resemble his uncle, in a kind of a fuzzy set, tied together by overlapping similarities. That was one of Wittgenstein's contributions that was extremely influential in psychology, and which I acknowledge him for. But Wittgenstein also said a number of other things, some of which are almost mystical. That is, you have kind of disciples arguing about what he really meant, which is always a bad sign in science. In particular, his insistence on language as a kind of game that has no connection to the world,
right.
That the limits of my language are the limits of my world, the denial that there could be any form of thought that was not in a public language, I think those were kind of on the wrong track.
Yeah. Okay, so I think we have, 5 minutes left? Okay, so I would like to turn now to questions of a more personal character. Now, what do you think are your major contributions to your fields of expertise, to psychology and linguistics?
I'm enough of a psychologist to know that I'm the last person who should answer that question. that would be a good question about my own ego, self-deception, self-delusion.
But objectively, I mean, some contributions could be measured in certain ways. And so if you were to single out one contribution, let's say, you would be proud of what exactly?
Oh,
I'm asking a more technical thing, not your books or anything, but just something in linguistics or psychology.
I guess in language, the thing I'm most proud of is coming up with a theory of how language learning works. That is, what is going on in the child's mind when a child born into the world doesn't know what language they're going to speak, but clearly has some kind of a brain that's prepared for language. How does a child actually listen to 2 years of sentences in Spanish or English or Japanese or Yiddish, and then 2 years later the child is speaking them themselves, not memorizing the sentences that they've heard from their parents, but being able to put together new sentences? That seemed like a total mystery, and I like to think that I had the first at least coherent and testable hypothesis as to how that works. What's in the child's mind?
It is surprising to me that it was not until Noam Chomsky in the 1950s that he pointed out this tremendous ability, that people before him thought that language is something that you learn just by imitation, which is actually impossible. It can be proved that this is not possible. You cannot just imitate. Just by imitation, you have to have a wiring in the brain. So what you're saying is you somehow have a hypothesis that you can test, in which you can somehow explain how this wiring is designed or how it interacts, and so that it would explain the development of language in.
Yes, I think that Noam Chomsky deserves tremendous credit for pointing out that this is the central problem in understanding language. Namely, given that any language is an infinite set of sentences, both you can prove it mathematically just by recursion, but also practically, we just know that when you speak a language, you haven't memorized a little phrase book like a tourist. But almost every sentence you hear, you've heard for the first time. There's just no limit to the number of thoughts that we can convey through words. So it's infinite in our everyday experience as well as the mathematical sense. And that implies that it can't be memorized. But nonetheless, we all can tell the difference between a genuine sentence of Spanish and a bad sentence by a foreigner or a Google Translate. So we have a very acute sense of what makes a sentence grammatical in our language, even if we have not heard that sentence. So there has to be some abstract set of rules, an abstract algorithm or recipe for producing an understanding that is not just a list of sentences. And that is what the child has accomplished in the first 3 years of life. And it is amazing that the child accomplishes it, and I tried to do my best to figure out how that worked.
So you have now a pretty good understanding about how this algorithm works, or this is something that is still very mysterious?
I think it's, and this is the reasonably humble part, I think it's still somewhat mysterious, but at least we have some clues. So I hope to have contributed some clues, or at least some coherent possibilities.
Okay, so a final question is something different. Even though you received the Richard Dawkins Award given to a well-known atheist, that is, why is it that, as far as I know, you never engage in public debates defending the atheist position or attacking religious beliefs, at least not like people like Christopher Hitchens or Richard Dawkins himself? Why is that?
Yes, it's funny that I never set out to be a atheist, secularist, freethinker, humanist, and I've gotten all these little statues and certificates on the wall. I guess I don't think it's an interesting enough question by itself, since it's the negation of a belief, and I agree the belief is factually incorrect, so I think it is good for someone to argue against it, but it doesn't excite me as a deep mystery to solve. It doesn't feel to me like a worthy scientific problem, whereas how do children learn language, why does violence decline, how do we form mental images, how does language change over history, those are all more substance, and the fact that God plays no role in it is kind of a byproduct, kind of by the way. Well, yeah, if you were to have God going Shazam, you know, miracle, that would make it impossible to do science. So yeah, you shouldn't believe in that. But that's not what I would consider the most interesting thing for me to accomplish anyway.
Okay, thanks. So I think we have 15 minutes for you to ask questions or make comments. So I don't know, I suppose you have a microphone. And,
Yes, I'm on channel 6 and I can hear you. Oh, what a beautiful room.
So I have a question about what you said about like children being able to form their own sentences when, well, not just by like hearing other people talk the language. And what do you think about Davidson's account for constructing meaning in sentences? That
I'm sorry,
words are not units of meaning, but the sentences.
Account?
I'm sorry?
I just couldn't hear right. Whose account?
Davidson.
Oh, O'Donnell Davidson?
Yes.
I'm not sure how it would be incompatible. And I'm sorry that I'm looking around because I'm not sure who's asking the question. I'm not avoiding eye contact.
Okay.
I guess I wouldn't have thought that there was a contradiction. It's that he would say that words are not units of meaning, did you say?
Well, yes, that's kind of, well, that's my understanding of Davidson's account of how we construct meaning in sentences.
Yes. Well, certainly, I can't say that I'm an expert on Davidsonian semantics, so I probably don't have a very informed answer. But certainly, at least in my understanding, it certainly is not just words. I think a big part of the problem, and an extraordinarily difficult one, is how do children figure out the meaning of words, especially verbs? And I wrote a whole book on what is a verb meaning and how does a child learn them. But it's also, of course, the rules of syntax that put words together into phrases and then bigger phrases and sentences. the rules of conjugation and declension, how you put the various suffixes on verbs and nouns. So I'm not sure that this answers the question, but certainly the problem for the child is not just to learn the meanings of words, but also how they're arranged in grammatical sentences.
Thank you.
Yeah, I have a question. And I was wondering how, in your opinion, how does linguistics affect human nature and morality, both in history and in individual lives?
Well, a lot of our morality could not have, at least the beliefs that go into our morality, certainly could not have been transmitted without language. Whereas there's some core aspect of our moral emotions that can be triggered just by sights and sounds. The sight and sound of a child in distress, for example. Children, even before they've acquired language, have certain moral responses, like helping someone who is having difficulty or who's dropped something. Children will get upset if they see someone in distress before they've learned to speak. But of course, the more developed moral systems that we have, both the religious ones that say that to be moral means to follow the commandments in scripture, or the secular moral arguments that say since animals have the same brains that we do, they must suffer the way we do, therefore we should extend our rights to them. Those could not possibly be shared without language. One of the reasons we have language is so that we can share our beliefs, both our technological discoveries, how to make something, how to cook something, how to hunt, but also our social beliefs, how we coordinate our behavior. How can you and I and everyone else do something so that together we can accomplish something that we couldn't individually? That's one of the reasons that our species has language, and therefore I think it's not a coincidence that so much of our morality is shared through language, at least the morality that depends on culture and belief.
Professor, thank you, Professor, for your wonderful talk. My question is the following. You talked about ideological genocide in Mao Zedong. 70 years ago, the world learned about the true horrors that went on in the Nazi concentration camps. Was that ideological genocide racial, religious? What does that tell us about a human condition, about human morality, what went on in the Nazi concentration camp?
Yes, well, the Nazi Holocaust against the Jews, but also against Gypsies and gay people, but the Jews being the primary target, was certainly an example of an ideological genocide. That is, it was not as if they had to eliminate Jews in order to take over their land, the way many of the genocides against Native Americans were motivated. But it was based on an idea. Totally crazy and evil idea that Jews were biologically selfish and conspiratorial, and that there was that the world was driven by racial conflict, and that the utopian world would be one in which the master race, the Aryans, dominated the other races and eliminated the worst race of all, the Jews. Now that's an idea. It's not based on trying to accumulate a lot of riches or a big harem of women or anything tangible, but it's an idea. It's a theory. It is a totally insane and monstrous theory. But yes, millions of people died because of a terrible idea. A number of historians believe that if it wasn't for Hitler himself forcing this theory over his country, that the Holocaust would not have taken place. The famous article, "No Hitler, No Holocaust." Probably the worst example of history of an ideological genocide, but certainly not the only one, because there have also been religiously motivated genocides. There was the the genocides perpetrated by Mao and Stalin and Pol Pot, also largely on the basis of bad theories. So in general, what makes an ideology toxic is when it holds forth the prospect of a utopia, that is a world that will be infinitely good forever. Because if you really believe that you could bring that world into existence, then you can kill as many people as you want, and you're always doing something good because you're delivering a world that's infinitely good. There was a saying in the Soviet Union, you can't make an omelet without breaking a few eggs. And putting aside the fact that people are not eggs, it's just a way of justifying as much killing as you want. Also, one of the things that makes an ideology so dangerous is when it proposes that the reason that we don't yet have a utopia is because of a certain class of evil people. People who stand in the way of that utopia, and that moral progress consists of getting rid of those people. In the case of the Nazis, it was the Jews. In the case of radical Marxism, it was the bourgeoisie in class conflict. In the case of religion, it's of militant religions, it's infidels and heretics and apostates. But whenever there is a demonized class that's getting in the way of a utopia, that is a major ingredient of ideological genocide. In my book, I talk about the whole set of ideas that tends to push countries in the direction of genocide, but those are the highlights.
Okay, unfortunately, I think we have to stop here because there is another talk coming, so we would like to thank you again.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you. Gracias. Thank you.
And I hope, sorry.